chapter 3 is where we were studying last week. And remember, this is the key passage concerning the universal guilt of sin. We also indicated last week that we would begin to look at the words used by the Bible to describe sin. And we were going to look at the 12 ones found back in the Old Testament that are described there. And we were as far last week as chapter 3, and we were down to verse 10. We have been through that, but let me simply outline it. 3:10. Chapter 3:10 basically begins to describe this way. It begins to describe the universal life of sin. Verses 10, 11, and 12. And we went through the factors. Verse 9, what then, are we better than they? The we being Jews, the they being Gentiles? No, in no way. For we have proved, both Jews and Greeks, that they are all under sin. And so all we're having now is an exposition of God has made an announcement that says this, all are under sin. And notice that is not a question that he sets up for debate. You may feel like you're a very righteous person, and that's fine, that's your right. You may feel like you're the greatest person going, that's fine, that's your right. But that isn't what God says. God's announcement is all are under sin. And again, keep in mind the perspective we've used last week. Remember, we judge people by having a dotted line, and the dotted line is Mr. Average Guy. And people go up from the average and down from the average. Some of them study very hard and become ethics professors in theological seminaries, and some of them work very hard and become felons and spend the rest of their life in the penitentiary. And then some others just border on average. They're not too hot. And then there are some that are just a little, you know, they're just kind of a cut above the average guy, like we would say, which is all fine and neat. Looked at from the side, you got all kinds of people. But remember what we have to do is that all of what we're studying is, does God look at people from the side or from the top? And if we could take this and stand it up on end, we would then have a straight line. And when you have a straight line and God looks down from his perspective on everybody, he says there's no difference. And we illustrated, you recall, by being on the 30th floor of a building and you look down and here's a guy 5'8 and here's a guy 6'2. And from the 30th floor, you cannot distinguish the difference between the two. However, if you were standing 2 feet in front of them, you could tell the 5'8 from the 6'2 very, very simply. Looking at them from the side is man's way. Looking down from the top is God's. And Romans chapter 3 is simply saying, want you to take a look at yourself the way God does, which is a thing we rarely do. We evaluate ourselves. We get evaluated by other people. And other people say we're slick, cool, neat, or something else behind our back, whatever. And if you really stop and think, aren't you glad that you don't know what everybody thinks about you? How would you like to know what everyone in this auditorium has said about you that knows you in the last year? Boy, I don't want to know. I thank God daily that I'm for the lack of omniscience, because I know. And the reason I know is simple. I don't know whether to tell you or not. The reason I know that I wouldn't want to know some of the things that you've said and thought about me is because some of the things I've said and thought about you. And I don't think I'm that different. Consequently, Paul is simply saying, all are under sin, and he's looking at it purely from God's vantage point. Then he begins to describe, remember the things. Number one, verse 10, there is none righteous, no, not one, period. There is none that understandeth, period. There is none that seeketh after God, period. They are all gone out of the way. And that's where we stopped, I believe, with last week. Did we get that far? Yeah, we did, didn't we? They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. Now we're ready for the part that begins to describe man from the standpoint of way we introduced it last week, giving the doctor's examination, which is basically looking at the mouth and the throat, putting the depressor on and saying, ah, because notice verse 13 begins as follows. Verse 13 begins to describe, and let's put that under this caption. Verse 13 begins to describe universal life of sin. And the examination begins. It says the throat, Greek word, larynx. The throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, and their mouth is full of cursing. So notice he begins sort of like the doctor does, with the throat, tongues, lips, and mouth. Now, it's very interesting. When he looks at the what we have in verse 13, the throat is the Greek word for larynx. And then he goes on to the rest of the part in verse 13, the larynx, the tongues, the lips, and the throat, or mouth, is it? The mouth. Notice he begins when he wants to indict men concerning their spiritual condition. Notice he begins with the organs used for speech. Now, why would God determine man's condition by looking at the origin or the organs of speech? For a very simple reason. The whole test of the total Christian life is ability to control the tongue. Look at James chapter 3. The total test of all Christianity is ability to control the tongue. It tells everything. James 2. Or James 3, rather. James 3. Basically, the thesis is going to be this. Your speech, more than anything else, reveals nature. Speech reveals nature. James chapter 3 begins with an exhortation, and the exhortation is directed toward the people that need it the most, since he is saying that the speech reveals the most of your nature. Then the logical thing is, let's talk to the people that do the most talking. And therefore, verse 1 is directed toward teachers. So right now, you can just kind of relax, and verse 1 is primarily to me, because after all, who's doing all the yakking tonight? You're not accusing anybody. You're not talking about man's sinful condition. I'm the one that's doing all that. All right, if that's the case, then notice what else occurs. My brethren, don't multiply teachers. Here's why. Knowing that we, teachers, shall receive greater judgment or condemnation. Why? After all, if you're going to be telling everybody how to live, then you ought to be doubly responsible. Then he begins the subject. Verse 2. In many things we all stumble. And anybody knows that. Anybody sitting here stumbles, sins in many, many areas. However, he says, if any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man and able to bridle the whole body. What is he saying? Not only does speech reveal your nature, but if a man's speech life is controlled, then everything else is under control. Now, that's kind of unusual, because very often we'll look at it this way. We'll say, well, here's this area of my life that I'm really having difficulty with. It's all out of control. Well, by the perspective of this verse, the basic control that could control this area over here would start where? We start with the tongue. So according to this verse, he says, if you can control that tongue, you've got everything made. So we could really also say this, that the essence of the control of the Holy Spirit is ability to control the tongue. Then he gives us a series of illustrations about it. You come down to verse 3. We put a bit in the horse's mouth and control the whole body. A bit's a very small thing, but look at the size of the animal it controls. That's like your tongue. Verse 4, look at a ship. The little rudder that guides the ship. The rudder's small, but look about how it controls the whole thing. And then he goes on and he says, continuing in the text, he talks about poison. How much poison does it take to do real damage? So his emphasis is that speech really reveals nature. And when you get a look at man's speech life, you've got to look at everything. After all, speech can do this. Speech suggests sin. Speech commits sin. And then when it does it, what does it do? Excuses sin. And isn't that about the way that the tongue works? It suggests it, coming from a mental attitude. Then it goes ahead and commits it. And then it says, well, the only reason I did it is because it's inherent in the family, and proceeds to excuse it. That's the danger involved in the tongue. All right, let's take that back then to Romans 3, and that's why Paul is looking at the universal life of sin from the standpoint of a tongue. And let me put down one more thing, and we're not going to pursue all of these, but here is God's method of indicting us all as sinners. His method of his indicting is simply going to do this. In chapter 3, 13a, he will quote Psalm 5:9. In Romans 13:13, the C part of the verse, he will quote Psalm 140 and verse 3. In the 3:14 part, he will quote Psalm 10:7. In 3:15 through 17, he will quote Isaiah 59 verses 7 and 8. And then in 3:18, he will indict us by quoting Psalm 36:1. Have we ever mentioned before at Beth Haven that there's no possibility of understanding the New Testament without the Old? If we have never mentioned that before, let me mention it tonight, just in passing, in case we haven't said anything to that effect before. Remember, the New Testament is rooted and based in the Old. And when Paul wants to indict man for his life of sin, it's just like that. Psalm 5, Psalm 140, Psalm 10, Isaiah 59, Psalm 36, and he weaves them together in verses. So notice then, beginning with verse 13, the first remark that he makes is to give a picture of what man's mouth or his larynx look like. He says his throat. You've got the patient there, mouth wide open, and you're looking down it. And the simile for the throat is an open grave. Now notice that's obviously a figure of speech. Now when you have a figure of speech, what do you mean by it? We have lots of them. He eats like a horse. And like a horse conveys to us the idea of tremendous quantity. A simile obviously has to stop someplace. Doesn't mean he eats hay. Doesn't mean he stands on all fours. It just means at that particular point, we understand the analogy. That horses eat, I guess, I don't know, I've never been near them, but they eat a great deal, and when you see someone that consumes a lot, he eats like a horse. Or if he's sloppy, he eats like a pig. And the like a pig is due to the fact that he's got mashed potatoes in his ears, etc. So, the idea is, God says, open your mouth. And when I look down your throat, I see a grave standing open. Now, what would be the idea of a grave standing open? Well, the Bible gives two explanations to that. One of them is that an open grave is often used to illustrate something is just ready to swallow a victim. So its first part of what it would mean would be its readiness to swallow a victim. And again, I don't mean to be morbid, but when you go by a cemetery and you see a grave being dug, you know that it's about to be occupied. And if you want to stand there and contemplate a little bit, you know that the open grave, which you are contemplating, is about ready to swallow a victim. Someone is about to enter the grave. Keep your finger here. Jeremiah 5:16 bears that out. Verse 16, he's talking about the enemy and their armament. And their armament, of course, at that time was the quiver or the bow and the arrow. And it says their quiver is like an open sepulcher. They are all mighty men. So he sees this enormous army, and the army is ready to literally eat them up. And he says, can I think of a good simile for an army being ready to literally consume everybody out there? He says, I got a good one. Open grave. And so part of the simile or the picture is ready to swallow victims. And God says, I look down at men, all men, and when I put the tongue depressor and you say, ah, I see an empty grave because I see something in every man. You're ready to swallow victims. We don't call it that way, do we? We have a little name for it. It's called dog-eat-dog. Now, don't let anybody kid you. The real world isn't that way. It's not dog-eat-dog out there. Someone made that up who just had some bad experiences. So don't let anybody kid you. It's not dog-eat-dog out there in the business world, is it, guys? Nah. So that is the first picture. Is he looks at man and says, basically, it's dog-eat-dog. You look like an empty or open sepulcher ready to receive victims. The other idea that would go with it, and this would be much more poignant if we lived in the times in which these people lived. You see, they didn't have very good air conditioning, and they also lived in a climate where a body that had begun to decompose would, especially due to warmth, leave a tremendous odor. I don't know whether you have ever, in police work they call it a stinker, ever run on a stinker or not. A stinker is a person that's been dead 3 or 4 days without being discovered. And you open a closet door and there they are. And suddenly, there they are becomes completely irrelevant. Because if someone with you happens to have a cigar, you want to grab the thing and eat it whole or do anything possible, you know, just to kill the horrible smell of a body that is decomposed. And if you know anything like that, then this simile is going to be very, very picturesque. He says it's like, I'm looking at you as man. I'm giving an analysis of your lifestyle. I look down your throat, and it's just exactly like here is a grave that they didn't cover up. You know, they put the body in it, and they did everything except putting the dirt in. And so the idea would be, in essence, you stink. You smell like an uncovered corpse. And again, I'm sure for some of you that experience this, you know just exactly. As a matter of fact, if you ever experienced it, you're smelling it right now. Because you never, never, never forget the odor of something of that sort. I will never, never, never forget, one that had come down the Missouri River from some distance and had bloated. And having bloated, the moment it was touched, it exploded. Never forget it. The smell is forever. And I'm not trying to to dwell on a subject. I am trying to get an image across from the text. So notice that God does have a very high opinion of us. Incidentally, isn't it amazing that in the light of the fact that we are like a smelly corpse that hasn't been covered, and in the light of the fact that basically the way we live is dog-eat-dog, God still thought enough of us to send His Son to die for us? That's the amazing thing. And remember when we started the doctrine of sin, we said, we'll never understand how great salvation is until you see how bad sin is. You can't see the greatness of the solution until you see the greatness of the problem. So there is his verse, very picturesque area in the explaining life of sin. Their throat is like a sepulcher that is standing wide open. Next, he looks at the tongue. And if this were not enough description already, he says, with their tongues they have used deceit. And deceit is a word that we have been over so many, many times. Deceit is the Greek word D-O-L-O-S. And dolos simply means a lure or your fish bait. And, of course, the object of a lure or the object of fish bait is to catch something. And you're supposed to, through, again, I'm not much of a fisherman. We went to Ocean City for $11. This guy took the friend I was with deep sea fishing. I went out about 30 miles. I thought, well, good night. I've never caught anything. I'll catch something. Sat out there 8 hours, got literally burned, got a crab, one, on that thing. I thought it caught half the ocean crab. Everybody else was pulling in the flounder and deep-sea bass and everything else. And I got all kinds of advice. They said, well, the tip of your hook is showing. So, well, you know, you hate to fool with the thing anyway. So I get I don't know what they're using for bait. Got the hook covered over, and every time you get the hook covered over, a crab would, you know, nip the top off. So I was told that as long as the hook was there, the fish wasn't going to bite, which was stupid. I wanted to go home because nobody out there that knows whether a fish knows whether he's looking. How would a man know whether a fish sees a hook or not? You know. At any rate, the Greeks, the object of the lure is obviously to deceive. Unless you fool fishy, you won't catch the fish. And the Greeks observed that lots of people live that way. Now, we have an expression for that too, don't we? A person who uses the tongue in order to entrap people and uses the tongue in order to manipulate his way through life, and basically that's what many, many, many people are, and that's what this is talking about. You're just the manipulator class. And that's very common, isn't it? We would say he has a sugar-coated tongue. Would probably be a closer idiom to it. And basically the idea is you do everything with reference to capture somebody and you use your tongue to do it. Such as, my name is so-and-so, I've been wanting to meet you, can I take you out for lunch? And the appearance is the guy likes me, he's going to buy my lunch. Until you get to the end of the lunch. And he opens his little satchel, and he said, your life insurance. And then it all lights up, you know, the lunch, the bill, you know. It wasn't that he liked me. He was there to sell. Nothing wrong with that, I guess. Except don't do that to me. It makes me mad. And you begin to think of how much of life that you face today is basically a bunch of sugar-coated stuff. Good morning. Glad to meet you. And I won't say, due to the nature of the group, the good old American idiom that really expresses the truth of what, you know, you feel about what they said. You weren't glad to meet them. If someone meets you tonight and says, we're glad to have you here, or I'm glad to see you, isn't that basically obligation? But basically, isn't it sugar-coated? Are there some people here tonight that you're not particular? Now, be honest. I know we're all saints, you know, of the greatest degree. But be honest. Now, aren't there some people in Beth Haven that you just don't really care for? Turn around, Jones. That you don't care for? Could it be possible that anyone might have even said of another believer in this church that he was a slob? Why didn't you tell them they were a slob? Why don't you just walk up and say, nerd? It would be honest. But you see, we learn something in life. Man, for heaven's sake, sugarcoat it. You know, be a gentleman, whether you are or not. And this is what God is getting at. He says, let's get down below the surface and look at the real nature of what man really is and how much we really kid him. After all, the person that says, yes, sir, thank you, may I take you to dinner, et cetera, and all of the nice things, he is just a little bit of a notch above the average, isn't he? And you have some people working in your office, don't you, that are not quite up to the average? They never speak. They always got a chip on the shoulder, and they fall down there. And God looks and takes the whole thing, turns it around, looks at it from the side, all under sin, and sees no difference about the little petty distinctions that we may make. So there is our second description, which is a description of the tongue, which is a sugared tongue, is the idea. All right, the next one coming down in the context. Incidentally, this is quoted from over in Psalm 14, Psalm 140. And it's interesting that in that verse, the Hebrew text, where it says in this passage, with their tongues they've used deceit, the word for deceit in Hebrew is sugar. So sugar tongue is it's a biblical term, comes right out of the Old Testament. They have sugar on their tongue. Okay, next, he looks down to the lips. And it says the poison of asps is under their lips. The problem to face right there, of course, is to say the poison of asps is under their lips is basically a matter of understanding, because what's an asp? Basically, you probably, in looking at it, say, well, it must be something in the snake family, and it is. The word asp in Greek was a word used for the Egyptian cobra. And its characteristic of the Egyptian cobra was the fact that its poison was carried in sacks. Little sacks under the mouth. It carried its poison supply in little sacks near the mouth. I'll just put carried poison in sacks. And let's see, I think unless you put your lunch in them, it's supposed to be S-A-C-S, isn't it? Instead of S-A-C-K. So that is the picture. Again, you'd have to live in the culture there. But the basic idea, notice, is you look at the tongue, and the tongue is smooth, it's sugar-coated, it talks nice, and yet it is used, and its function is always, remember this, it's always got poison at the side. Then the next is the mouth or the tongue. Actually, the tongue in Greek. Says the tongue is full of cursing and bitterness. First of all, the word cursing is the Greek word ara, and the Greek word ara means two things. First of all, the Greek word ara is a common word for a prayer. The word translated cursing means to pray. You say, well, how in the world do they get cursing out of that? Well, when you pray, you say something like this, don't you? You say, Lord, I ask that such and such will occur. I ask that it will rain tomorrow. And someone walks up to us, and that's prayer, isn't it? All right. When you walk up to someone and say, go to hell, what are you doing? You're making a request of them. it's figurative speech, I think in most cases figurative speech, at least I hope so, it's figurative speech, but basically what is it? You're making a request. And of course within this context, it is that that their mouth is full of requests that are bitter. You know, I do hope you fail, ultimately. I do hope that you have a wreck with your car, though we don't maybe say it out loud in the interest of courtesy and public relations. But notice, this doesn't give a hang for public relations. This is just the way it is, and when you really are honest about it, isn't that the way it is? I mean, this is really life, and this is really where men live and where what men really are. Okay, I do have an English word, it's kind of interesting. The word profane, P-R-O-F-A-N-E. Anyone know the derivation of that? It's kind of funny. A fane, F-A-N-E, is an old, old English word for church. And pro is a Greek word for out in front of. And so profane language is the kind of language that they said people don't use when they're in church. Out in front of the church language, anyway. Okay, 3:15. Now notice we started clear up here with the head, the mouth, and everything, and now he goes all the way down and concludes the whole being in verse 15 by saying their feet are swift to shed blood. And so the idea is man is sinful from head to foot. Now the next thing he does is to give a little, beginning in the 17th verse, a little tangible proof that this is really true, because you might be sitting back and saying, I mean, man's not that bad. I just can't buy that it's dog eat dog. All right, notice the next verse is going to be the verse that will prove that what he says is really true. Notice he continues with a expression, verse 16. He says, destruction and misery are in their paths. And the first word that is of extreme importance and very, very, very vital is simply the word that is translated destruction in the context. The word destruction is the Greek word suntrima. And it would be spelled something like S-U-N-T-R-I-M-M-A. And the word suntrima is used of anything that is smashed. It means crushed things, destroyed things. And that enlightens the text. Think back at human history. And he says the path of human history is a path strewn with crushed things. And can you deny it? Isn't that basically you look back and you do see some good things? But basically, what do you look back at in terms of history? You're looking back at a course of crushed or destroyed things, misery in their ways, and then verse 17, the way of peace they have not known. And there's his final indictment, is that man has never known peace. And when you look at that, remember we mentioned, four or six weeks ago, the historian, and I can only quote because I am not a historian, who put as much recorded history together as he could. And that amounts to, I guess most of your historians will say you start history maybe around 4,500, maybe 4,000 B.C. You get back about 7 or 8, that's not history. I mean, that's pretty much guesswork. And I think almost all your historians are going to say real history, you know, that pretty well puts it together, starts about 4,000, 4,500, and comes on up to the present day. And the one professor, I do recall he's a professor at Cornell, his little area of research was, I wonder how many times in the total history of mankind we can find gaps of peace. In other words, periods when, as far as we know, nobody in the world was really actively fighting anybody else other than family disturbances. Meaning, how many times can we find when there's either a national conflict or an internecine warfare of some type, a civil warfare of some type, how much can we line up in human history? And the biggest hunk that he could get together was 200 years. And that wasn't consecutive. I mean, that was putting, you know, a year over here and then trying to put together a couple of years here and stringing it all together. That's a fantastic record, isn't it? And that's exactly what he's saying. He's saying something is wrong with man. He can't get along with man as a whole. And you look at it on a horizontal level, and basically on a horizontal level, he doesn't do very well. And if you look at it on a family or a marriage level, even on a family and marriage level, people don't cut it too well. Because even in the homes of Christians, I mean, I hope God doesn't hear this because we don't want to surprise him, but even in the homes of Christians, you have an awful lot of hell, you know, that is present. And exactly what's wrong? Well, one says it's your fault. The other one says, no, it's your fault. You did this, and if you weren't such a so-and-so, this wouldn't happen. And if you hadn't done this, and, you know, back and forth, which never settles anything. You know what the problem is? It's both very simple. All are under sin. Husband, you are a no-good, lousy rat. Wife, you are a no-good, lousy rattus. That's the problem. And it's not a matter of, you know, tit for tat and who's going to, you know, work out what. The biblical solution is we are basically men under sin, and all problems issue from that. And therefore, the only possible conceivable solution begins in the direction of something very simple. It begins in the direction not of solving the man-to-man or husband-to-husband problem. It comes in this. Husband, the rat, gets a right relationship vertically. Wife, the rattus, gets a right relationship vertically. And it's amazing. But there's an axiom that follows all the way through Scripture. Two people cannot be right with God and be wrong with one another. Now, that doesn't mean that, and I wouldn't want to convey that marriage is the idea of two people marry, and the picture is a beautiful sunset and two people riding off on the horse into the sunset to a life of bliss and beauty and wonder and everything else. Because we're human, and due to Betty's sin nature, she does some things that are terrible. And, of course, due to my advanced state of maturity spiritual, I am able to handle and capable and take care of all those things. And, of course, she never finds any fault or thing wrong with me. And if she does, it's because of her sin nature. We all know that. It didn't work that way at all. It's exactly the situation that if she is right vertically and I am right vertically, we have got harmony. If that is not the case, you can talk and talk until you're blue, purple, green, and every other color. And nothing works out until we relate vertically. And that's exactly what Romans is trying to do. It's beginning the book by saying, look, cut it straight with yourself, will you? Stop the sugar-coated stuff. Stop the idea of thinking that you're a beauty, and let me tell you in frank terms, all I can see in you is an old, stinking, rotten grave, ready to gobble up victims. You've got a sugar-coated tongue, and every time you use your lips, they're full of poison, and you're ready to shoot somebody, and that's exactly what you are. You don't seek God. There is none righteous, no, not even one. This is exactly plain, flat out and out what you are, everybody. Now he's going to say, if you'll recognize the reality and cut the illusion stuff and recognize this is really what I am, then you're in a place where I can begin to show there is a solution. And you say, well, what solution can I provide? Well, that's part of the news, too. You can't. Not a thing under the sun you can keep to doing. As a matter of fact, you read this when you're 1, 2, 3, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 years old, and you're still the same old person down on the inside. But there is divine solution when we get to the area of soteriology, or really, if you're kind of new with us, we're starting on Sunday morning at, what time is Sunday school? 10, up here in the auditorium to study the basic doctrine of the Christian life. Which is basically, how in the world do you get things straightened out vertically so that things won't be such a mess horizontally? And the amazing thing about it is that you don't handle the horizontal problems. You handle the vertical ones. It's just exactly like if I've got a horrible toothache. I can get that taken care of with a shot. But does that really take care of it? Especially if the cavity is deep enough. I'm not curing anything. All I'm doing is shooting something in there to keep the pain taken care of. The basic solution has to be arrived at, then the rest is cared for. And this is exactly the reason we're handling the doctrine of sin in preparation for our next doctrine, which will be the doctrine of salvation. All right, basically then, we have the passage dealing with the area of the universality of sin. Now, we said last week we'd get started, and we only have about 10 minutes tonight to do so, but we have said we would get started this week in the words that God picks out to describe sin. The Hebrew language is extremely pictorial, and in no place does... In fact, one of the interesting things about studying your Old Testament that is very difficult for us that live in the 20th century, the first thing is when you pick up your Old Testament, the first enormous problem you've got is translating it. And the reason you've got an enormous problem in translating much of the Old Testament is that it is so earthy. I mean, it is just plain earth, guts, mundane speech. And being the Word of God, I do not hesitate to mention that because if your mind cannot take this, then I take it there's something wrong with your mind. But when I talk about being earthy, you go back in the book of Kings, and God is telling the people to go in and destroy all the males, and he very bluntly, in quite earthy language, says, destroy everyone that pisseth against a wall. Now, that just isn't, we don't say it that well. I guess some do. That isn't exactly the way you would write it, you know, for the front page of the editorial or on the editorial page of the Kansas City Star. That's the Hebrew. I mean, it is a gutsy, down-to-earth, not dirty, I don't mean obscene, very, very earthy kind of language. And consequently, they did that because they wanted to be pictorial. And, of course, they lived close to the earth. They lived with elements that we separate ourselves from. And consequently, one of your problems with the Old Testament when you deal with it is if you translate it literally, then you say, well, you know, I wonder if the kids ought to read the book of Isaiah. And again, I do not mean obscenity. I do not mean being dirty. I just mean it's mundane. It's just earthy. It's just plain, down-to-earth kind of language. And therefore, very, very descriptive. Now, the Old Testament also does this. It treats all disorientation, all disorganization, all confusion in life to one source, and that is sin. And we're going to write out, or at least get a start tonight, at the words that it uses. The first word that is used is one we've already studied, but we'll do a little more with it. It's the word chata. And I'll put it down, and under the H, I'll put a little dot. That means it's rough. So don't say chata, say chata. Chata. Got any good Germans that can... You got a guttural like that in German. You got any of those? We got any krauts here? Anyone do it for us? There's a German word under the illustrator, L-O-C-H. How do you say it? Who did it? Lach. Is that it? Okay, good. Chata. Now, why don't you go ahead and write it in Hebrew, too? Put parentheses. The first letter looks like this. And that's the... Forget that little doodad down the bottom. That's the letter Chet. And that's a consonant, like our A. And when it looks like a little T like that, that's ah. So that says ha. And then, if you make a little curlicue around like that, and my writing's terrible, that's their t sound. And then that thing is your ah again. And then another thing like this, only notice the little thing doesn't touch the little deal. That means this is just... And it's because the little leg doesn't touch the little top that you've got to... Boy, this is edifying. All right, the word we're dealing with is chata. You've got it now both written in Hebrew characters and in Greek and in transliterated characters. Now, the basic meaning, remember, is to miss. And let me give you a passage where you'll see it very vividly described. It just means to miss. Oh, incidentally, if you got room, and I'll take the word sin and put a circle around it over there. And what that means is that's the way King James translates it most of the time. Most, not all the time, but most of the time. Most of the time, chata is translated S-I-N, sin. And it means to miss. And a good passage to see the word chata is Judges 20, verse 16. Judges 20, 16. Judges 20, 16. Did I ever tell you about the first time I ever spoke to a group on a Bible study in public? I'd gotten a brand new Bible, and the first portion I asked them to turn to was, would everyone turn to Hosea? And I hunted and hunted and hunted and hunted and hunted and hunted. And do you know they had bound that thing with... If you notice how Bibles are bound in little, you know, little sections. And those no-good rascals had bound it without Hosea. Finally, some little old lady offered her Bible, you know, for the poor fellow that was going to teach. And Hosea was in her Bible. Which all proves the Holy Spirit has a sense of humor. I know he knew I bought that Bible without Hosea in it. He knew I was going to preach to that group, and he knew how stupid I was going to look, and he let me look that way anyway. Judges 20 and verse 16. Judges 20 and 16. Reads as follows. It's talking about the armies and the power of these men and their efficiency in their warfare. And it uses our word that's usually translated sin, and it says this, chapter 20 and verse 16. Among all this people were there 700 chosen men left-handed. Everyone could sling stones at a hair's breadth and not chata. Good verse to illustrate it, isn't it? Not miss. And that is the word selected by God, the most common word in the Old Testament selected by God to describe the idea of sin. Now, that simply means then that all sin is a coming short or a missing. It is a coming short or a missing of what God expects of man. All sin is a coming short or a missing of what God expects of man. And we ought to add, in case we have any question or mind about what he might expect, remember Genesis 1:26. God said, let us make man in our image. We are supposed to be like God. And I'll put Genesis 1:26. God said, let's make man in our image. In other words, we are supposed to be like God, in God's image. And what have we all universally done? We have universally and without exception sinned. Missed the mark. And that is our first word, our word chata. Incidentally, if we would trace that throughout the Old Testament, we could say one thing also. It didn't make any difference whether you did it on purpose or didn't do it on purpose. it could still be hata. You could say, I'm going to miss the mark because I want to. Or you could miss the mark, for example, you had lots of ceremonial regulations in the Old Testament. Among them, for example, was how a man could shave his beard, how he wasn't supposed to square it off. And you could say, well, I didn't know that was in there. And God will say, well, I know you didn't know it was in there, but it was still in there, and I'm going to call your failure to obey it chata. So miss it on purpose or miss it not on purpose, that didn't cut any ice. It was still a matter of chata, basically, to miss. Okay, we've got time for one more word. There are 11 of them, so and we can't cover all 11. This is the word ava, and write it this way. Put a little apostrophe there. And then an A-V-A-H. And then the Hebrew word, make a little thing like that. And then put your ah sound under it. And then make a little thing like that. And then a little thing like that. And that means ava. Now, I cannot do it. I used to be able to. But I saw no reason why I should continue trying to do it. See this letter right here? It's the letter ayin in Hebrew. Only the way it's supposed to sound, you know that little, see, you got the soft palate, and then, what's that, little hanging down thing? Epiglottis? You know what I mean, don't you? Is that an epiglottis? Or just plain glottis? What is it? Uvula? Oh. Okay. Uvula. Okay, now, what you're supposed to do, when you say an ayin, that little thing is supposed to do a little flip. And you're supposed to get your sound from that uvula. And it's very hard to do. It's a sort of ayin like that. So that the whole sound comes from right back down at that little thing. So, really, you might go, it might be fun going home in the car. Or maybe you replace Walter Cronkite tonight by sitting around going, you know. Might be even appropriate to the news. Who knows? At any rate, we'll just call it for since we don't want to have any injuries. Someone have to go to the doctor tomorrow trying to pronounce a Hebrew word. Let's just say ava is the word. And the word is often translated wrong in our Bibles. Now, when I put these words in circles, I don't mean always. I just mean the lion's share, you know, most of the time. Usually translated wrong. The word ava means literally to be crooked. Anything that wasn't straight. To be crooked. Or warped. Or distorted. Anything crooked, warped, or distorted, or bent. Anything that wasn't shaped the way that it was meant to be shaped. Now, our word wrong isn't a bad translation. In fact, it's a pretty good one. See, all of these are looking at sin from different aspects. One aspect of sin, it misses the mark. It does not live up to what God expects man to be. That's one aspect. All right, now let's look at it from, move over to this side. You can look at it from this side also. It's like a board that's warped. It just is not like what it ought to be. It's warped, it's distorted, it's bent. Anyone know why the word wrong would be a good translation for it? You know what wrong comes from, English? Wrong used to be pronounced wrong. Like when you say, I'm all wrung out. And for something to be wrung is, I'm not sure with older middle English, but our word wrong means wrung, and the word wrung meant to be bent, distorted, or completely out of shape. So that you can look at sin from the standpoint of being something wrung out of shape. Now, since we've got 9 words to go, we're not even going to be in it to take the full hour to touch them. It'll take our entire study, as a matter of fact, next time. And what we'll do is this. Next time, we'll draw a circle. And we'll divide the circle up into 11 parts. And the whole circle will be the sin circle. And we'll take each one of these verses, and each one of these verses will look at sin, for example, as to what is missed, the word hatah, as what is caused when you sin, and it'll be the word amal, and then what is lacking, which will be another word for it, and then from the standpoint of what is violated. And we'll try and get a total Old Testament picture of just exactly what is involved in the concept of sin. Amazing, in the light of all this information, that God would turn around and then say to us, I'm willing to give you everything I've got, namely my Son, to die for your sins. And if that doesn't create some thankfulness, and if that doesn't make some decent people out of some cranks, nothing in the world will. Father, we're thankful for your word tonight. It's living and powerful. We're thankful.